Hello and welcome to The Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what factors led to Western dominance of the world and how are they now changing? Finally, on the Scholar Circle, the effect of war on laws, society, governance, and democracy itself. How are these affected as the lines of wartime are increasingly blurred? We are joined by Stanford University historian and classics professor Ian Morris, who has looked to the beginning of history to answer the question of why the West rules for now, the patterns of history, and what they reveal about the future, which is the title of his book. Welcome, Ian Morris.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
I think the place we should start is what you mean by the West and the East and how you define them and why you settled on an East-West dichotomy for this book.
There's been all these debates about why the West came to dominate the world. And a lot of these debates break down because people are defining the terms in different sorts of ways. One person will say it's all about democracy or it's all about Christianity. Somebody else will say we need to look at a totally different set of factors. So I tried to figure out what are the debates about Western domination really about. It seemed to me what they're really about is the ability of societies to impose their will on the world, to get things done, master their physical and intellectual environments. You know, the best way to think about this over the long term of history was by attempting to measure social development over time. And I decided the best way to go about doing this was to look back over the history of social development, to find the point at which you first begin to see really different ways of living and lifestyles in different parts of the world. And this comes about 15,000 years ago, the end of the Ice Age, as the world begins to warm up. And in certain parts of the world, people are able to begin domesticating plants and animals. And as they do so, they have access to just a lot more energy than ever before. And the populations get bigger and bigger. And the societies get more and more complex and more different from each other. I looked around the world at the places where these processes began. And it's really a very limited number. As the populations grow, these areas get bigger and bigger, and the farming and cities and states and empires spreads out from these original cores. And so I took the westernmost of these core areas in the old world, which really starts up in what we now think of as Southwest Asia. All the societies that descend from this westernmost core, I'm going to call Western societies, and all the societies are modern complex societies that have descended from the easternmost core, which is out in China, I'm going to call those Eastern societies. Because in fact, the societies that have had the highest levels of social development in the last 15,000 years have always been ones that descended either from the original Western core area or from the original Eastern core area.
In today's language, you hear much more discussion about the global north and the global south. So, for example, the global north kind of exploiting the global south. Do you think that the east-west is sort of expiring and opening way for a north-south debate?
Well, I think the north-south debate is a really important way of understanding why the world is the shape that it is, kind of why the distribution of wealth and power are as they are. This is something Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, and does a wonderful job at tackling the north-south question, asking, you know, why is it that societies in the northern hemisphere are so much richer than those in the southern hemisphere? He goes back to the end of the Ice Age to identify why complex societies began developing first in the northern hemisphere and then went on to become so powerful there. He's less focused on the question of why it is within the northern part of the world that in the last couple of hundred years it was Western societies rather than any others that went on to dominate the whole planet. So I guess the question I was asking in my book was more focused within the northern part of the world. Why is it the Western societies? If you go back a couple of hundred years, we see this great surge in wealth and power beginning in Western Europe, spreading quickly to European colonies overseas, like North America. And then in the 20th century, though, we've seen the rapid spread of these levels of industrialization and social development and wealth around the rest of the world. And the last 50 years or so have been seen a billion people in East Asia lifted out of extreme poverty as more and more wealth flows into those societies. And I think what we're going to see across the next 50 years will be the continuation of this. East Asian societies will continue to get richer. Areas like Southeast Asia, South Asia, at the moment just beginning to climb onto the same ladder, they're going to do so much more fully. I think we're going to see India, Pakistan becoming much more important players on the global scene. And increasingly, I think large parts of Africa seem to be moving in the same direction. You know, we often tend to think of Africa as just this disaster story. And you know, what we see on the news is always about coups and massacres and disease. But in fact, the last 10 years or so, Africa has seen fairly remarkable economic growth. General standards of living have started to rise a lot faster.
There are a couple of things I think we should discuss. One is, you said historians really weren't looking quite far enough back in order to discern the pattern that might really be occurring. And then the second thing is that you said, well, there is the role of the Industrial Revolution, but it really rests within these other three paradigms. It's deeper. It's biology, it's sociology, and geography. So why don't we start with the historian issue? And, I mean, you went all the way back to the beginning of the universe.
Yes. Yeah, which is a long way to go back.
It really is.
Winston Churchill had this line, the farther backward you look, the farther forward you're likely to see. I think this is absolutely true. If you want to be able to look at enough of history to be able to see what the big patterns are like, you need to combine the methods of the archaeologist with those of the historian, taking in the whole prehistoric period. And certainly, I think you need to go back at least as far as the end of the Ice Age, 15,000 years ago. There's really three things you need to know about to explain the history of the world. One of these is biology, which, of course, tells us what we are. We are clever chimpanzees, and our humans are all much the same wherever you find them in the world. I think this is the big lesson of biology. The second thing I suggest you need to know about is sociology, which I use in a rather loose sense in the book to basically mean the full range of the social sciences, which I think tells you how humans in large groups behave. And if you put those two together, you get a kind of generalizing theory about all of humanity at all times and all places, why it is that humans have been so successful at doing certain kinds of things, why it is that societies have changed so much, and why sometimes the societies don't change, and why sometimes we see great collapses rather than steadily rising social development. The problem with a sort of biological, sociological theory is if you want to know why some societies have developed so much faster and further than others, for that, I think the third element you need to add in is the geography. It's the different places that make all the difference. The people are all much the same. The societies they live in all develop along much the same lines. But the fact that the societies are in different places leads them to different outcomes. When you can see enough of human history, what you realize is that biology, sociology, geography, put together, these basically answer our questions.
Let's back up and look at these a little bit more closely. You say biology matters because?
That sort of tells us what it is that we do in the world. What we do, I think, is really not that different from what other animals, or perhaps you might even say all other life forms do. We need to extract energy from the world around us, otherwise we simply die. When we can extract more energy than we need just to keep puttering along, we tend either to turn it into bigger versions of ourselves. So we've always seen this in the last 30 or 40 years. People are getting just bigger and bigger and bigger. And in fact, it goes back a couple of hundred years. 200 years ago, the average adult, pretty much anywhere in the world you look, is about 6 inches shorter than they are now. In the last 200 years, we've been able to capture so much energy from the world and convert it into food that we've just made ourselves bigger. When we're not busy doing that, animals tend to convert extra energy into just more of themselves. And humans, of course, have done exactly the same thing. We differ, though, from the other animals in that our evolution has produced this weird brain, which is really nothing quite like the brains in other animals. And it's so complex and so big that it's allowed us to invent cultural evolution. Any other kind of animal in the world, they have basically one way of doing things. Gorillas have one way of organizing their societies. Chimpanzees have one way of doing this. And wherever you look at a chimp or a gorilla, it's basically the same kind of society. Humans, of course, aren't like that. And we are able to respond to what happens in the environment around us by changing our societies. So we can go from simple hunter-gatherer bands to more complicated, more hierarchical peasant societies, to very hierarchical empires, and then to modern industrial societies, which in some ways are much less hierarchical than peasant or imperial societies.
And so that would bring us to the sociology. You cite a science fiction writer, Robert Heinlein, who says that we're essentially lazy people and that you think that the change is due to laziness, greediness, and fear.
That's right. Robert Heinlein, back in the early 1970s, came up with this saying that people often call the Heinlein theorem. Progress is caused by, you know, lazy, frightened people. Nowadays, we'd probably want to be a bit more cautious about the evaluation terms. I think most of the time, we don't really know what the effects of our actions are going to be. But the most of our actions, I think, can be broken down under these three headings of fear, greed, and sloth.
I also wonder if that's only part of it, and there's really this other side that would be less cynical, the kind of ingeniousness, inventiveness, and altruism also motivating people. And I'm thinking of great science, great philosophers, great statesmen who also have shaped history.
Yes, it doesn't seem to me to be all that cynical. This, of course, is one of the ways in which we are different from other animals. We're more ingenious, and even more important, we are able to preserve some of our ingenuity because we have modern speech. We've now, of course, got writing and all the technologies associated with that. So we can pass these things on and teach to other people and to future generations what we have learned ourselves. The fact that, you know, humans can have an Isaac Newton, whereas chimpanzees can't, this is obviously an important part of history. But when I started looking at the big span of human history, it seemed to me that one of the most striking things is this question of what is it that drives the great episodes of ingenuity, the Isaac Newton type episodes. And when you start burrowing into the details, the ingenuity tends to be driven all the time by these factors of fear, greed, and laziness. It's people respond to the challenges that the world puts in front of them. And these challenges, it might create a situation where you say, aha, I make some kind of new widget. I start doing what I'm doing in a different way. This will maybe allow me to get by without having to work as much. And I think this probably has a lot to do with the agricultural revolution initially. People figuring out ways to get higher yields from plants without having to wander around the countryside gathering food quite so much. Or it might be that, say, you're in a situation of climatic change and the traditional ways of doing things just aren't feeding your family anymore. And so you're becoming very fearful. And this is a great spur to innovation and invention. Or you may find that you simply are blundering into discoveries. And so when I look back over the history of the great men, the great women who've made the inventions and launched the wars and so on, what I found over and over again was that it's the changing environment around the people that drives them to make these great discoveries or do these terrible things to each other.
And so that leads us to the last piece, which you say is geography. You say what distinguishes the destinies is tied to geography. You start with the Earth's orbit.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the Earth's orbit is a rather more complicated thing than we normally tend to assume. But the processes, of course, are unfolding very slowly. The Earth wobbles and shakes on its axis as it goes around and the sun. This, over the long run, produces these great cycles in climate, which have had an enormous impact on the way that the societies have developed. As I worked my way through history, looking at the big episodes of change, again and again I found that it was geography that seemed to be in the driving seat. And geography was what was thrusting the great challenges onto people, which forced them to be creative or destructive or whatever the case might be. But it also dawned on me that the reason why I think often historians haven't always seen the importance of geography in the bigger story is that geography itself works in a rather complicated way. I think it's like it's a two-way street, this relationship between geography and society. Because on the one hand, geography determines how societies develop, and where you are in the world is the single most important factor in determining how quickly it's going to develop and what precise direction. But at the same time, the way societies develop determines what the geography means. And so some geographical facts that in one period of development might be a very difficult thing for you, creates all kinds of problems, in another period can suddenly become this enormous plus. The classic example of this would be, say, about 600 years ago, around the year 1400. If you were dropped down into Western Europe in 1400, you would find that it was a pretty marginal place. It's a long way from the real centers of action, where China is the real center in 1400. The Mediterranean basin is a fairly important center. And Western Europe is stuck out into the cold waters of the North Atlantic, long way away, basically nothing very important is going on there, then that suddenly changes. And all of a sudden, sticking into the Atlantic Ocean goes from being this disadvantage, you know, it makes you a long way from where everything is happening, into suddenly being a huge plus. And the thing that happens is that in Eastern Asia, social development is rising so high, and Chinese society is becoming so creative and inventive, that the Chinese come up with two great new inventions in the 13th and 14th centuries. One is ocean-going ships, which allow you to cross entire oceans. And the other is guns that work, which allow you to shoot the people you meet when you get to the other side of the ocean. And these things spread like wildfire across Eurasia. Within 40 years of the first known gun in China, the first known guns are also showing up in Western Europe. And once this happens, once development reaches the point that these new inventions come in, all of a sudden, the fact that Western Europe sticks out into the Atlantic goes from being this bad thing to being this enormous plus. Because now Europeans find that they are only about 3,000 miles away from the Americas, whereas people in East Asia, to sail with the winds and the tides, you're going to have to cover at least 6,000, probably 8,000 miles to get to the Americas. And because people are all basically the same and societies are all develop along rather similar paths, the fact that it's so much easier for the West Europeans to get to the Americas and the East Asians means that it's the West Europeans who do it first. And the West Europeans colonize the Americas and plunder the Americas and draw the Americas into an economic system based on Western Europe. I suggested that's what then really propels the West to the top of the pile, this new economic system they create, because geography changes its meaning. And if you look back through human history, all the way back to the end of the Ice Age, you see this sort of process going on again and again and again. Geography drives how the societies develop. But as the societies develop, that changes what the geography means.
So let's take all of these patterns that you have found and apply it to the modern day crises in some way, because we're dealing with a lot of issues. We're dealing with dwindling resources in some cases. We're dealing with climate change. You suggest that we're seeing certainly a rise of the East. How do you see this affecting the future in terms of all of the big crises we're facing?
Once you understand the role that geography has played in world history, the rise of the East starts to become very understandable. The kind of geographical forces that propelled, first of all, Western Europe and then North America to global dominance, these have continued operating, and they're now drawing in East Asia as well. East Asia is starting to gain on the Western world in power and wealth. When you've looked at history, there are really two lessons you can draw. And one is that you can identify the patterns that have driven history, and you can project these forces forward into the future and ask you, what will happen if current and recent trends continue operating in more or less the same way? Where will the world be in 100 years' time if we're just in a kind of steady state of change? The other thing you can do is, when you look back over history, you find that the forces of social development very often generate forces which then undermine social development. It's like societies create their own problems to a great extent. You solve one problem, it just creates a new problem to solve. And so I think you can combine these two trends, the big forces drive history plus the counter forces that generates, to get at least a rough sense of where things are likely to go. If we just project trends forward, then within the next 100 years or so, Eastern social development is going to catch up with Western social development. Certainly by the end of the century, the world's centers of wealth and power will have shifted away from North America and toward East Asia. I also suggest that if we do that thing, project recent trends forward, what it suggests is that by the time the Eastern development catches up with the Western, levels of social development will have risen so high that the world is going to be completely different from anything we can now imagine. The scale of changes in the 21st century will just beggar all the changes we've seen in the last 15,000 years. It's going to be an extraordinary time. The future just won't be like the present. So I think that's one possible outcome. If the forces that have shaped history up till now just carry on working. But like I say, the problem with that is that development tends to generate forces that undermine it. And so when we look at the great crises going on in the world today, a lot of the forces that are so disruptive now are exactly the same ones that have been enormous problems for rapidly changing societies in the past. So climate change is one of them. Mass migration, often driven by climate change, is one of the forces we may have to deal with in the 21st century. New epidemic diseases, again, over and over again in the past, this has been an important force of disaster. We seem to be looking at that on the horizon at the moment. Large-scale famine, the pressure on food resources around the world has really been increasing in the last few years. And then the collapse of states is the fifth of these forces, which, of course, we're seeing happening around us at an accelerating rate. We've seen the collapse of states in the Middle East, not yet clear what's going to come out of these upheavals. So I think you can see a lot of the same forces that have operated in the past continuing to operate in the 21st century. I think the big question is which path is going to win out? Is it going to be some great transformation of societies, or are we heading for some kind of catastrophe?
And your answer to that?
I'm guardedly optimistic. I think that the biggest thing we have to worry about is not so much forces like climate change in themselves as how humans react to these forces. And you know, it's very easy to put together scenarios where climate change can drive governments do really rash things in response to it. It can set off wars as it triggers mass migrations. It's certainly not beyond the realm of possibility that we will see a major nuclear war in the 21st century. We often tend to assume that since the fall of the Soviet Union, that's kind of off the table. I think that's a little optimistic. It may not be off the table. I take some encouragement, though, by the way that the Cold War ended. If we've been having this conversation 50 years ago, and I'd said to you, in 50 years' time, the Soviet Union's leaders will have looked at communism and looked at the economic development of the USSR, we give up. We'll just unravel the whole thing, we'll dismantle our empire in Eastern Europe, and we'll all go home. You would have thought I was mad. And yet that's exactly what did happen. And so I tend to think that if we were able to make it through a crisis like that, then we really ought to be able to deal with the kinds of challenges we're facing the 21st century, too.
I want you to talk about two last things. One is, at the end of your book, you talk about a lot of the technological developments. You talk about genetic advancements. You talk about these computer capacities that, quoting Ray Kurzweil, these are powerful enough to run programs reproducing the 10,000 trillion electrical signals that flash every second among the 22 billion neurons in a human skull. That was his quote. And then you talk about DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, the research into modifying humans, the Silent Talk Project, IBM's project. There are a lot of these really, on one hand, fascinating developments, on the other hand, frightening developments. And then you talk about the concept of getting to a point of singularity. Talk about what some of these projects are and what they mean for society. And then talk about your concept of singularity and how that plays into this.
So this all came out of this idea of, you know, what if we take the trends that we've seen in history and project them forward across the 21st century? You know, where will this take us? And so one of the things, like I said, is that I think we will see Eastern development catching up with Western development. But then the other interesting thing about this was seeing just how high in terms of social development things are going to rise across the 21st century if change keeps accelerating at the rate we've seen in the last 100 years. As I was running my calculations, looking into this and thinking about where is this taking us, that led me on to looking at the work of some of the futurists who've been speculating on where recent trends are taking us. And generally, I tend to think that when you're looking at predictions of the future, any specific prediction is likely to be a million miles wide of the mark. If you look back at what people were writing 100 years ago, most of the time it's pretty funny. But on the other hand, when you look at the sort of general trends that scientists are talking about, then I think we are on much safer ground in talking about where the future may be taking. And the most striking of these trends, I think, is these linked revolutions in genetics and nanotechnology and robotics. And like you're saying, one of the ideas people often discuss is Ray Kurzweil's suggestion that the power of our ability to scan the human brain and the power of these biggest supercomputers we're building are both increasing exponentially. And if you plot out where these trends are taking us, Kurzweil suggests that within the next decade, we're going to see scanning so powerful, we can actually reproduce a map of any specific human brain as a piece of software, basically. And within the next 20 years, we'll have computers powerful enough that can run that software. So this, in a sense, this would mean you personally could be duplicated on a silicon platform rather than on a carbon-based platform, which is what you currently are, you know, carbon-based, biologically evolved creature. Within the next 40 years, we ought to see supercomputers so powerful that they could pool maps of all of the human brains in the world and kind of merge all of human intelligence into a single machine-based intelligence, which would have trillions of times the thinking power of all the humans in the world currently combined. Which astonishing vision of the future. And I sort of suspect that as a specific prediction, things probably won't turn out that way. But this general direction is where things seem at the moment to be going if the historical trends continue. And so, yeah, I mean, the DARPA, the Defense Research Agency that you mentioned, one of the things they're currently working on is a way to do a very Kurzweil type of thing, but put implants into the skulls of soldiers so that these implants will be able to read the electrical signals flashing around in your brain, which, you know, of course, are your thoughts, which you then verbalize by sending further electrical signals that ultimately come to your tongue and allow you to speak. But the implants will kind of intercept these electrical signals, and then send them over the internet as electrical signals to the implant in the brain of some other soldier. So you'll be producing what they like to call network-enhanced telepathy, which sounds like Robert Heinlein, sounds like complete science fiction. But an NSF report just a couple of years ago was fairly confident in predicting that we should see this during the 2020s. That, of course, is just one example of the many, many things that are going on. This is why I end up the book by suggesting that if these sorts of trends continue, we're looking at some kind of transformation of humanity in directions utterly different from anything that's happened in the past. If the transformations don't continue in that direction, we then have to ask ourselves what might conceivably stop them. And when we start thinking about the kinds of disasters that would need to be unleashed in order to cut off these transformations, and then we also start thinking about the kinds of weapons we now have in the world, that is when the scenario begins to get a bit scary.
And as for the singularity concept,
yeah, this is an idea of Ray Kurzweil's that he picked up from earlier philosophers. The idea that you reach a point in time where change becomes so fast that it basically becomes instantaneous. So things simply disappear even, you know, as they get formed. New things get invented, they are immediately outdating themselves. And his idea is that as we see the development of these totally new kinds of computing intelligence that really can think for themselves, they will be reinventing themselves on this timescale so fast that it will appear that change is happening instantaneously. Which, again, you know, sounds like a very science fiction kind of thing. Except that I think, you know, if you think about the world we live in now, the rate of change that we're experiencing now, and we're coming to take for granted now, would have just been unimaginable to somebody living 1,000 years ago. And the sort of things that we've become accustomed to, I mean, like, you know, talking on the telephone right now, or, you know, listening to the radio, or let alone going onto the internet, or getting on a jet plane to fly to another continent, this would have just seemed like magic 1,000 years ago. Things we take so much for granted now, like television, would have just seemed unimaginable. Perhaps the sort of changes that are implied by the extraordinary transformations that might be coming in the 21st century, these perhaps are not quite so unthinkable as we might at first assume.
Ian Morris is a professor of classics and history at Stanford University. His latest book is called Why the West Rules for Now, The Patterns of History and What They Reveal About the Future. When we come back, how the changing definition of war and wartime impacts society, the law, and democracy itself. Stay tuned.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I know.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. When will the wars be over and lives return to, quote, normal? Those times seem increasingly elusive as the lines between wartime and peacetime are blurred. The so-called time of war affects every aspect of life. It changes laws, civil liberties, and the public's relationship to the law, bending the laws in favor of security for the state, and ultimately affecting democracy itself. War also demarcates history eras. But what about when war seems to go on endlessly? What exactly is wartime, and how does that blurring of lines affect laws and society? Three experts join us now. Mary Dujack is professor of law, history, and political science at USC and author of several books, including Wartime, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. Patrick James also joins us. He's director of the Center for International Studies, a professor of international relations at USC and author of numerous books, including Religion, Identity, and Global Governance, Crisis in War, A New Quest for International Peace, and Wars in the Midst of Peace. Chris McKnight-Nichols joins us. He's professor of history at University of Pennsylvania and author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. Mary Dujack, let's begin with you. Your concept of wartime as a construct that has been kind of imagined, as you say, somewhat differently than its reality. How have we come to see wartime, and how does that articulation affect the fundamental legal and cultural aspects of life?
Wartime does a lot of work in American politics and culture. We see the concept of wartime often being used as an argument for why we should adopt policies like enhanced interrogation, for example, waterboarding. Why do we do things like this? Because it's wartime. When someone uses wartime as an argument, they're basically arguing that the nation's existence is at stake, but also that wartime means that what we're doing is going to go away, because built into the concept of wartime is the idea that war is, by definition, temporary. And the reason I say that is we imagine history proceeding from one kind of time to the next, from wartime to peacetime to wartime to peacetime. We imagine that there's a future called peacetime where war will not exist. So wartime brings with it the idea of war's temporariness. And the way that it figures in, we'll see, for example, the Supreme Court grappling with the question of how do we deal with the legality of detentions at Guantanamo. Well, under the law, enemy combatants can be detained for the duration of the conflict. And so these folks are being detained for the duration of the conflict. And yet the conflict, the way it's been articulated, doesn't have an end point. If it's a war on terror, the way Bush put it, if it's a war on Al-Qaeda, the way Obama has framed it, then these are wars against concepts or tactics or amorphous groups that aren't going to cease to exist anywhere in the world for a very, very, very long time, if ever. So we essentially have this idea that war is temporary, that wartime policies are therefore temporary, but that coexists with a context of ongoing warfare that doesn't fit the concept.
There are two directions I want to go in. One is going to be to bring in Pat James to look at this from the international relations perspective, and then with Chris McKnight-Nichols to look at this historically in the United States of America. Pat James, within the context of international relations, wars, ethnic conflicts, what Manus Midlarsky calls systemic wars. What is the international political context for war, wartime, and peace?
I think Mary is right in her book with its emphasis on the evolution of a concept, this whole idea of wartime. It almost ends up being a major pun in that we close our eyes and we envision old movies where there's a home front and there's a fixed period of time where the boys go marching off and then they come home, and there's sort of an end point then, if you will. Somebody then wins the war, the winners write the peace, and so on and so forth, and they put the bad guys on trial. What she points out, I think, so well in her book is that whether you look at it as a cumulative, gradual process or something that's more binary because of 9/11, this whole notion that, quote-unquote, war is this discrete thing in time that you could make movies about, you could write books about, and that somehow it begins and ends. And then from a sort of international relations / international law standpoint, there's wartime law and there's peacetime law. All of that, by the time you get through her very masterful and easy-to-read work, all of that is gone. It's incinerated, and the situation is much more complex. I would say, for me, the most interesting thing from an international relations standpoint concerns the relationship of prosecuting a war to the legal foundations of going to war. And by that I mean the United States, for example, has not actually declared war on anybody since December 8, 1941, namely against Japan after Pearl Harbor. Since then, the U.S. has been involved in any number of military deployments, but there's nothing that looks exactly like a stereotypical war. And where we are is that the conflicts we have, like Afghanistan or whatever, they're not even really about a place anymore. They're sometimes about concepts, about tactics, whatever we might call them. One key thing for international relations scholars to think about then is, because of this mushiness, this lack of boundaries, that the law and legal precepts are much more in play 24/7, 365 than they once were. My own particular comment on this is that we have to think very seriously about what we are willing to do and how far we're willing to go if we deploy force. I'll stop there for the moment, but I'm a big fan of thinking that parallels what's been known as the Powell Doctrine, as in, if you're going to do it, then go all out and get it done and be extremely, extremely restricted in your usages of force.
Chris McKnight-Nichols, let's bring you in and take a look at this from the historic context in the U.S.
Mary makes some superb points in the book regarding the longer history of wartime, particularly in the 20th century. And here she really illuminates sort of the central paradoxes and the social constructedness of time, wartime and peacetime, as a kind of facile binary. And she begins with a great incident, unfortunate incident, the last peacetime casualty or wartime casualty in this case in East Germany of a fellow by the name of Arthur Nicholson. And the question is sort of severalfold, whether or not he deserves burial in Arlington National Cemetery, which he does receive, then what should be written on his gravestone, killed in East Germany, U.S. military liaison, doesn't state formally what conflict he was engaged in. And so this gets at for the question of what exactly was the Cold War, as a series of hot wars, of proxy conflicts. And then she opens that up to sort of think through what most Americans would perceive as perhaps the most discrete of conflicts, the Second World War, beginning for many Americans with Pearl Harbor, of course, and concluding with the peace signing on the battleship Missouri, or perhaps simply with the dropping of atomic bombs. And here, Mary's work also shows us what those of us in historical circles know well, the long lead time into these conflicts is just as important. One insight that I would draw from the book more broadly is that Americans are very often de facto committed to conflicts, whether they be small or large, World War I, World War II, Cold War examples. So too are small conflicts, such as American engagement in the Philippines, which lasted from 1898 through 1946, when the Philippines gets its formal independence. But the U.S. sort of has a vacillating relationship with these conflicts in terms of the sort of constructs of wartime and peacetime, and yet the commitments are just as strong. Troops are dying on the ground, just like Arthur Nicholson, who was laid to rest in 1985, and yet the sort of existential question about what is this war remains. And it strikes me that historically, pushing back even farther, we have several other questions related to this at the intersection of the law, history, and conflicts. Abraham Lincoln's famous suspension of habeas corpus and the related rulings on that in the Civil War era through the end of the 19th century, the Spanish-American War, and Mary's comments just now to start off our conversation reminded me of William James's remarks about something related. That is, he argued that a concept such as manifest destiny, which seemed to motivate so many Americans in conflicts, the sort of belligerency and passion of Americans in wartime, are really empty concepts. He argued that they were, quote, specious abstractions. But the problem, of course, is that there's a great traction of these kinds of concepts, like wartime or like manifest destiny, that make it particularly problematic in terms of democratic accountability in times of war.
As we're looking at this kind of relationship between war, society, law, democratic participation that is really all linked into when a war begins and when it ends. Mary, you have looked at several wars. World War II was one. The Cold War was another. The War on Terrorism was another. And they're very different kinds of wars. You tried to define them. What did you conclude?
What I do in the book is I start by taking apart the concept of wartime, and then I look at a series of examples to illustrate the pliability of the concept, the way that it doesn't fit into time boundaries the way we imagine it. So I look at World War II really not to define it better, but instead to illustrate that the way we think about World War II doesn't fit, and that's that it's now remembered as the good war, the quintessential kind of war, in part because it was a declared war, so it's thought of as having a definite starting point, and then it all ended with VJ Day, the Japanese surrender in 1945. But instead what happens is even that iconic war is fuzzy at the edges. The U.S. involvement ramps up over time, as Chris suggested, and U.S. involvement and deployments sort of continue on afterwards. The Cold War, then, is an interesting problem because, you know, how does the Cold War fit? Even the name, the Cold War, is incoherent because wars aren't cold. So it should cause us to think about what was this and does it actually serve as a useful comparison with other things we think of as a wartime? And what you see is there's just not a fit between this long period of diplomatic tension where the wars that are going on are usually proxy wars, smaller wars, different places in the world where there's a central adversary is the Soviet Union. So the Cold War itself doesn't fit within the usual definition of war, the way we tend to think about it. But what happens often in the scholarship, including the legal scholarship that uses different wars as examples to think about American war policy and the law over time, the Cold War is basically shoved back into the pre-existing, simpler conceptual framework that we have wartime and peacetime and we move from one to the other. Then the post-9/11 era is on some level a repeat of the Cold War history, where you have another period that simply doesn't fit the model, as we see so clearly now as first President Bush, then President Obama, trying to, at least as a matter of American politics, say that conflicts are ending, but they just won't end. And then we're sending military forces other places like drones over Pakistan and Yemen, etc. So what we have is this much messier era of ongoing conflict. But what scholars do is, at least in the law world, they start calling wartime something different because post-9/11 doesn't seem to fit. So then they call it a crisis time. They rename other war times as crisis, like World War II now is a crisis time, so that they can compare different crisis times against each other, but still have this general assumption that there's something called normal time that we experience that's periodically ruptured and then restored. And so that basic temporal set of ideas, which builds in the idea that war is by definition temporary, you enter it and those powers and those rights of compromises are by definition going to come to an end. That conceptualization lingers.
Pat James, let's bring you back in because this muddling must really affect the international relations scholarship. How does the international relations field deal with counting them, knowing when they are resolving and not resolving, when you have this kind of gray area?
Yes. What has happened, if you follow the scholarship in the area, is there is an awareness of this change in that once upon a time, let's go back close to 50 years ago during the early days of high-speed computing and the ability to construct, you know, large-scale data sets, initially very discrete, very standard-looking events like World War II and others got packaged together into interstate war data sets. What we've seen since then is an awareness of two things. One is that the boundaries of such discrete events are breaking down. So instead of collecting data strictly about traditional interstate wars between two countries, scholars, in fact, over the last few decades have evolved toward not only collecting that, because sometimes we have things that look like a traditional old-fashioned war, like the first phase of Iraq in 2003. But then many of these conflicts, of course, don't end like an old-fashioned war. they morph into something else. A reasonable person could say that there's still some kind of conflict going on in Iraq right now, or for that matter, Afghanistan, even though at one point each of them was an old school type of war. You'd have to say they didn't end up in the traditional old style way where they had a clear point of termination. And the other thing that's going on, and it's connected, is that most of the casualties around the world from warfare are being experienced in unconventional types of events that are more civil than international and that do not have clear beginnings or endings. Some of them arguably are discrete. They're taking place inside the borders of one country, but some are not, like what went on in the mid-1990s in Africa. Some have called that Africa's Third World War, right, with the Congo and Rwanda and so on and so forth. So there is an awareness on the part of the scholarship that the events aren't as easily packaged as they used to be, that they're not strictly interstate, and most of the lethality out there, most of the casualties, that's really coming from things that don't look like old school wars.
So it's really almost like there's this continuum of conflict that ebbs and flows rather than something with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
That's right. And to the extent that you can even find a beginning, middle, and end, it won't even look like it once did, where there's a clear declaration of victory by one side or the other, defeat for the other adversary, and then look what happened with Iraq, a perfect example here, Afghanistan. It just doesn't look anything like the World War II model where you had the trials in Japan and Germany of war criminals. Here it's so ambiguous and so muddy. When Mary mentioned something like, for example, the controversy that has gone on over the detainees at Gitmo, well, that, the last time I looked, was the winning side, right? I mean, it's the winning side that was being criticized for its actions in relation to the quote-unquote losing side or adversary. That's just unthinkable, if you will, until very recently. So that also, in a sense, challenges beginning, middle, end, good guy, bad guy, victory, defeat. It's just a whole lot more gray than black and white.
Chris McKnight-Nichols, let's bring you back in. How do you fit these, say, the war on terror, within a look at American history with its engagement in war or restraining an engagement with that middle ground? And look at it also from this perspective that you have explored with regards to isolationism and the middle ground there.
I think Mary's book really usefully illuminates the best comparison of the war on terror to a historical precedent, and that is the Cold War, a war that's conceived of as having a discrete enemy and a confrontation between two powers. And yet, ultimately, it isn't taking the shape in the present in terms of the war on terror, or in the past in terms of the Cold War. It did not take the shape of a kind of conventional war. In the longer history and historiography, to compare the international relations to history as well, I think the divide is really that scholars, I agree completely, scholars have found this gray area in terms of the actual fighting of conflicts and the ways in which, in the U.S. tradition, conflicts have had ramifications well beyond the scope or the seeming time period of a given war. World War I is a great example in terms of the curtailment of civil liberties and the kind of reaction in the 20s and 30s to the civil liberties that had been curtailed in the course of the conflict, that is the Espionage and Sedition Acts and the ways in which those prevented sort of First Amendment rights from being exercised. However, the divide between scholars and the public at large is the one that I think really is being addressed by these questions we're talking about, and that is Americans tend to think of their own history as divided into this neat periodization of wartime and peacetime. And while scholars may have done significant work to add complexity to that and nuance, we're still struck by the sort of consistency of this paradigm between war and peace, even if, at least in the last half of the 20th century through the present, the U.S. has been more or less in a state of wartime throughout that period. Those are essential issues. I think also, in terms of isolationism and international engagement, you see here one of the ramifications of my reading Mary's superb book was thinking through the ways in which so-called peace times are moments to grapple with perhaps the undoing at home and abroad of American ideals. And here my reference before to William James fits in. Americans after the Spanish-American War of 1898 really did begin to grapple with the fact that perhaps having territories and being a colonial power was anathema to the nation's sort of revolutionary origins. That is, as James and the anti-imperialists continued to argue through the early 1900s, that ruling alien peoples against their will was something that no nation born in revolution should do. And so, too, I would say we see in the unfolding 100-plus years the ways in which Americans debated their role in the world after conflicts theoretically had ended. So even though American troops, they don't fully come out of Europe until 1923, and the armistice having been in November 1918, Americans in the 20s and 30s are vigorously debating whether or not the nation should employ its troops abroad. However, scholars would argue, note that the U.S. was deploying Marines throughout Central and South America and the Caribbean throughout that period. So the sort of waning and waxing of wartime and peacetime also dovetail with debates over an isolationist or internationalist perspective on committing diplomatic and military force abroad.
Now, I'd like to go back to this central question that I believe, Mary Drujak, your book is ultimately addressing, which is when we are in a supposed wartime, a time of war, it erodes much of the public's vigilance and engagement, as well as their civil liberties, so that it's ultimately eroding democratic structures at the same time. What I'd like to do is to have you address this question here, and then I'm going to reverse this to Pat James to look at the effect of democracy on wartime. So first, wartime's effect on democracy.
One thing that's important in our current era is the way that everyday Americans have been encouraged not to be engaged with their nation's military deployment abroad. If you compare that with World War II, sometimes Americans have been encouraged to be engaged, right? World War II plants a victory garden, buy the war bond, which is a way that the Roosevelt administration tried to get the American people themselves to feel that this was a war that they personally were involved in. Now, fast forward to post 9/11, and of course, we were told not to sacrifice, not to participate, but to go shopping, go on vacation, or the terrorists have won. I think Obama is doing his own version of the same thing. Tie a yellow ribbon, send the troops a thank you note, but let's not be deeply politically engaged with what they're actually doing. And so the more the American people are isolated from the cost of war, which we are, with no draft, with more outsourcing, with more use of high-tech warfare, and the American people are isolated from the sacrifice of war and encouraged not to be politically engaged, what that then leaves us with is no meaningful political check on the war powers. I think that we're at a moment in American politics when we have to ask whether there's a means of having a workable restraint on the president's ability to go it alone. And I think the only hope is if the American people are more deeply engaged, then they, through their Congress members, can, whether it's a war declaration or other kinds of congressional action, that's the way the people can have a role, right? In our system, it's generally through Congress. But also we saw in Vietnam the way the people unhappy with the course of the war in Vietnam had their say by getting out in the streets. And so one of the reasons you don't see any meaningful pushback from American war policy is that the people aren't engaged, and so we have no democratic accountability.
How does that fit, Pat James, with the democratic peace theory, democracy's effect on war?
Well, the democratic peace theory is about pairs of countries, so it doesn't contradict it in the sense that democracies are very happy to go out and beat up on countries that are regarded as being miserable and unpleasant to deal with. Certainly the United States and other leading democracies like Britain have had no hesitation in going to war. The democratic peace thesis is about, of course, how much the democracies are very fond of each other. It's morphed into a whole gigantic industry of adding in other variables, as in, gee whiz, is it because they're rich, actually, or is it because they tend to be able to have enforceable contracts with each other? Reasonable people, and I'll cut very quickly to the chase about what the research is saying, would say that it's, as opposed to being atomic, it's molecular. It's not so much democracy as a cluster of interrelated traits that the leading countries like the U.S. and, let's say, Britain, for the sake of argument earlier, had. Namely, there's a system leader, the U.S. now, and they tend to be rich, and they tend to be capitalists, and they tend to be investors, and so on and so forth. So really, none of what Mary says would threaten the democratic peace. The much more interesting question, of course, is, all right, if that's intact, what about all this war that seems to be going on? And if I could take a few moments more, I quite agree with her on the disengagement. The symptoms are all over the place that the brilliant analysis offered by Mansur Olson in The Rise and Decline of Nations 30 years ago is right on target, in that take two rather odious traits of the United States right now. One is it's absolutely ridiculous and profligate overspending, and the other is that it's seemingly, you know, almost mindless involvement at times in overseas conflict with no apparent or obvious cost to the public that leads to protest. All of this makes perfectly good sense when you look back at what Olson said 30 years ago, that eventually interest groups of one stripe or another, if left unchecked, will take over and dominate a political system. So I would say that what we have ultimately right now is what Eisenhower warned us against when he left office in 1961, a very powerful military industrial complex that is eating money up like candy, alongside any number of other interest groups that have created huge, gargantuan even government programs that we can't afford. And the public kind of blithely goes along with it, because only now are the cracks in the edifice starting to come to the surface, as in who wants to lend the United States money anymore, who has enough to do so to afloat American debt. I think these phenomena of huge unchecked government activities are very much connected to each other.
Chris McKnight-Nichols, we're going to give you the last word. I have one thought I'd like to interject here, and that is, you know, George Orwell in 1984 wrote about perpetual war, while Immanuel Kant wrote about perpetual peace. I guess we're not in number two.
Perhaps we are in a state of perpetual war. One thing that both comments just now remind me of is Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America argued that one of the most terrifying things for all republics is what he called military glory. And he contrasted the American case with that of Europe, and he got a few of these things right and a few wrong. But what's most interesting, trying to modernize that sensibility and thinking about it in both the legal and international relations as well as historical context, is exactly this, your point, that in a state of perpetual war, one other variable seems particularly salient that we haven't talked a lot about yet, and that is technological change. And Mary mentioned drone strikes. But it seems to me that on questions, say, about the War Powers Resolution of 1973 and whether or not Americans are likely to protest in terms of any of our ongoing conflicts or perhaps future conflicts, the fact that these wars are being waged largely by technological means outside of the purview of Americans and with somewhat dubious international legality strikes me as perhaps the most salient new development here, a change from the sorts of questions that Americans asked after, say, the Second World War. Was the second dropping, if not the first, of an atomic weapon morally justified? For example, we don't seem to be having those sorts of deliberations about drone strikes, at least not significantly. And that would be something that would be good for democracy.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. So let me thank the three of you, Mary Jujak, professor of law, history, and political science at University of Southern California, and author of several books, including the one we're talking about, Wartime, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. Patrick James is the director of the Center for International Studies and a professor of international relations at USC. He's authored numerous books, including Religion, Identity, and Global Governance, Crisis in War, A New Quest for International Peace, and Wars in the Midst of Peace. Chris McKnight-Nichols, professor of History at University of Pennsylvania and author of a number of books, including Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Maria. Take care.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at armudian. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.